I'm Celine McKay, and you're listening to the Pure Green Podcast, episode 30. Welcome to this week's episode of the PGM Podcast. I've got a special interview for you today, a guest that our listeners requested and I'm excited to have on. I'm talking with Jonathan McKay, Pure Green's food editor, and yes, you guessed it, my husband. I have to say, interviewing your husband is an interesting challenge, but it was fun, and I don't think it'll be the last time he's on the show. In our house, life more or less revolves around the kitchen. We start talking about what to make for dinner early in the day, and we look forward to it all day long. We cook for the love of it, and we're also pretty passionate about eating healthy. We've taken great care to involve our daughter Charlie in the kitchen too, and despite the fact that she's only two, she likes weird stuff like blue cheese and strong, bitter, sun-ripened olives because we expose her to absolutely everything. So far, it's looking like she'll fall into step no problem beside her foodie parents. Although I grew up with a mother that only cooked real good food. When I first met Jonathan, I was beyond hopeless in the kitchen. He, on the other hand, has a weird sixth sense when it comes to food, like many a creative cook. He talks in the episode how he can taste how things will go together in his head, and it's this ability I've always lacked. But cooking is something we've always done together, and I have to say, under his tutelage, I've become a decent sous chef. Jonathan likes to cook fast and loose, he says, and it's true. There are few rules in his kitchen, except perhaps for how we treat his good knives. As he says, food is enjoyment, and whether it's a Wednesday or a Saturday night, we eat like kings. I'm a lucky woman and so happy that you get to meet him today. Here's Jonathan. Okay, Jonathan, I wanted to lead off with a couple of questions that would help our listeners get to know you a little better, get some context for where your love of food truly comes from. So I wondered if you could share with us what your earliest food-related memory is.
I remember being interested in making stuff and wanting to experiment with recipes, and I can't say that I remember what the recipe was. I know that it had chocolate chips in it, but whatever it was, I have a fairly sharp memory of it being inedible. But it was a good start to my my creative food path. So my poor mom had to deal with all kinds of ingredients abuse as I was growing up, but that one memory stands out in my mind as something that was just really foul.
So how old would you have been at this age?
Maybe 7 or 8.
And this was just a food experiment that went wrong?
Yeah. In fact, all of my early memories of food really relate to food that went wrong. I have an uncle that likes to bring up quite frequently on a camping trip that I decided to buck the trend and make chocolate bannock, which is like this dense bread that you can make when you're camping, and it lives in infamy.
Okay, so where do you think your love of food and cooking came from?
I think that easily was introduced to me by my mother. She was a really good cook. She was not a conventional cook by any means. She was not, let's just say she had a whole lot of recipes that she fixed or followed loosely. She never really, she always had her own way of doing things, and I think that's where I learned to really enjoy cooking. Because it wasn't, with her, there was no boundaries. You kind of just, it was an artistic expression, and I was always kind of a creative little kid. So, I like to, paint and things like that too. So it was a great expression for me, but I was also high energy and needed to be hands-on all the time. So cooking was something that I could really dive into.
Okay, so I'm curious, this might be a tricky question, but what do you think are the greatest lessons that you took in the kitchen from your mother?
Don't be confined by other people's ideas or you know, specific specific rules to cooking. They're really, you know, there are base techniques, but there are no rules. And, you know, great things are created by experimentation. Don't be afraid to fail, you know, because you learn more from failing than you do from succeeding in many cases. And, you know, when it really counts, you know, trust the recipes that you know.
Yep, that's true. So what was a favorite childhood meal then that she made?
Oh, mac and cheese.
Right, and that's, well, of course I knew that. And the listeners or longtime readers of the magazine may know that that's actually been featured before in volume 7, actually. So we can find the recipe there, and I'll post it online too, but it's a really good one.
Yeah, lots of my favorite recipes have come from, you know, kind of childhood favorites that I've reinvented just to make a little bit more relevant to my, you know, my style of cooking now.
So, well, that brings me actually to my next question really nicely. So your style of cooking, or I always like to call it philosophy on food. So I'm curious as to, well, first maybe you could answer what your style of cooking would be, because I have a feeling that's a little bit different than your philosophy on food.
Fast and loose.
Okay, so what does that mean?
Style. I don't really have a... I don't know if I can sum it up. I just have a... I like to just follow my intuition when I'm cooking, and I don't like to be constrained by a recipe. So when I find a recipe that is, I really like, I'll look at it, I'll look at the ingredients, but then I'll kind of, you know, I'll tweak it to the way that I like my food to be. And, I would encourage everybody to do that with every recipe, mine included. That's how food becomes great for you. But I think my style is more, I don't know, it's born out of necessity a lot of times. It's like, we have three ingredients in the fridge, what are we going to make?
Right. Well, you always tell me more. Put as much as you think and then double it. So, you or triple it sometimes.
I like bold flavors,
yeah,
for sure.
That's what I was going to say. You like bold and strong, yeah, I mean, I guess it is a tricky one to really get into, but you do have a style, I think. I mean, you like to let the flavors really come out, but at the same time, you also like simplicity.
I like food to be simple and complex at the same time. Mm-hmm. Complex because the textures and flavors are very layered, but simple because they are, they're practical to make, and they're easy to make for the most part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So... then, how do you describe your philosophy on food?
I should have anticipated this question. food should be enjoyed. I think that you really, you know, it's important to eat healthy, but it's important to enjoy eating as well. I think that there's an emotional aspect to eating that, you know, you can eat the healthiest stuff in the world, but if it's tastes terrible and you don't enjoy it, that's not going to, in my opinion, help your health, because there's an emotional aspect to eating. It's, you know, food is one of the biggest necessities of life, you know, aside from water and air, that's what we need. So, you know, my philosophy is that you should eat well, and that means eat healthy, but eat good food, eat food that you like as well. And then, you know, beyond that, I really believe in, you know, whole foods and wholesome ingredients. I don't believe in processed food at all. But I'm also not, I don't feel 100% constrained by, you know, having to do the 100 mile diet, or, you know, some of these very strict, diets, which, you know, are great, but I just have you know, I don't like being constrained by that. I like to be, you know, really open to all kinds of possibilities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, your style does evolve a little bit as a result of that. And because it's enjoyment for you too, I mean, that really shows through. And I love that. I mean, I think that food so often gets, you know, we get stuck in a rut because you're hungry and you have to eat, but you have no time or whatever it may be. And so often you lose that spark of creativity because you're just feeling so constrained by life generally.
Yeah.
Which actually leads me to a question that I was going to ask you a little later on, but I think this leads into it nicely, which is, you know, in our family, we prioritize cooking. We prioritize cooking good food. And that means that we're cooking what a lot of people consider elaborate meals on a daily basis. And it also means that sometimes we don't eat until like 8:30, 9 o'clock, which I would love to sort of fix. But I mean, it is what it is. And I would take the good food over eating earlier for sure. But, you know, so because of that, like we have consciously pushed things away and we've consciously allowed that time to cook. And what place do you think cooking has in the modern family, in your opinion, when everyone has no time and, you know, store-bought meals are kind of becoming a bit more normal because people are often complaining that they just don't have the time to cook at home. So what advice would you give listeners who are hoping to cook in that way but feel like they can't or like they're constrained by just busy lives?
You know, this is an easy thing for me to say and a much more difficult thing to do, and we find it difficult as well, but it's something that I know that I have to work on. And it's check your priorities. I mean, food is important. And traditionally, life has evolved around food. It's, you know, it's growing it. It's harvesting it. It's drying it or storing it. It's preserving it. It's cooking it. It's eating it. And, you know, basically, you know, there is this subsistence lifestyle that we've grown away from because of modern convenience. But I think sometimes we need to slow it down a little bit and realize, hey, like, this is truly important, particularly when you have a family that you want to take care of and keep healthy. And so I think it needs to be more of a priority to eat well. But at the same token, I understand a busy life. I understand it as well as anyone does. Mm. And so how do you then produce good, wholesome food and still maintain this lifestyle? Well, there's lots of ways to do that. And, you know, you can cook in batch and eat leftovers, which, you know, we do a lot.
Yeah, we do.
In fact, we have our whole fast food freezer where we do our, you know, take a Sunday and cook, you know, 5 gallons of vegetarian chili and you know, that's our pizza night basically. Mm-hmm. So you know, I think it comes down to spending enough time to organize yourself to be able to do it in a way that fits into your lifestyle, but making sure that it's still a priority because, you know, for your health and energy and vitality, it's paramount.
Mm-hmm. I think another thing, something that came to mind for me anyway as I was listening to you, is that cooking often falls on one person in the family. And, you know, so the burden is mostly on them. And that's, you know, it's just the reality. But it's a more difficult way to do it, sort of, in a way. So in our family, something that we've done is we've gotten involved in the kitchen together. And, I mean, you're the one with the skill in the kitchen and the creativity. I need a recipe. I can't create. Except that, I mean, I've learned enough from you that I'm getting better, but I can definitely help. And that's something that I've always loved about us. I think that some of my favorite memories it's just time spent in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. And you telling me what to do, me asking how much of this and that, and at the end we have something that we created together and we're looking forward to eating. So it just makes
the
whole...
And then it's cold by the time we've written it down so that we can put it in the magazine.
That's true. Yeah, but it creates anticipation and also makes a bit... It's a collaborative thing and it makes it almost more of an event.
It's something that a family can do together, for sure.
Yes, exactly, which just brought me to the point that Charlie, being only 2.5, still, I sit around the counter and she watches and she mixes the bowl, makes a huge mess, and I try not to care. But, you know, like, it's just been really, really important for
us.
And
she loves doing dishes.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, to involve her. So if you could pass only one thing on to Charlie about food or cooking, what would it be? Like, one single takeaway, probably the hardest question to ever, but...
Yeah, wow. To boil it down to one thing.
One piece of wisdom. You want to make sure she absorbs.
It's important. Mm. So take time for it. Enjoy it.
Mm-hmm. Eat real food.
And, yeah, eat real food. Yeah.
So...
The odd smarty isn't going to kill you.
No. No, it's not. So, a lot of readers have given me feedback that one of the questions that they wanted to make sure that I asked you was what your creative process is like in the kitchen. So, you know, I know that when it comes down to creating recipes for the magazine, I mean, these, most of the time, aren't recipes that we created exclusively for the magazine. They're recipes we cook in real life, and... We cook, and it turns out to be really great, and then we write it all down before it's gone, and that's usually where they come from. But there is a pretty, you know, what is that spark, the whole creative process for you start to finish?
You know, it's funny. I have 100 cookbooks that I've never opened, and I buy them because I'm so, I look at what other people are doing, and I get so... excited by it, and I want to sit down and look at it and get some ideas and stuff. But the reality is, you know, I'm one of those people that has a busy lifestyle, and I spend more time cooking and less time, you know, researching into it, to be honest. But my creative process tends to be something will just spark it for me. So whether it's going through the market and seeing like these perfect vegetables, you know, if it's, sometimes we're going for a walk and we're just talking about something and all of a sudden I start to just taste things in my head and I start to build a, you know, build a recipe in my head and think, oh, you know, these ingredients would be good together. And sometimes it's, just, like I said, out of necessity, I open up the fridge and, you know, you've got, 4 or 5 things in there that are somewhat unrelated and, you know, figuring out how to just bring them all together into something that's delicious. So my process is a little bit varied, but usually there's some kind of a catalyst that gets my, you know, gets my internal food dialogue going, and then that's how most of these things come into being.
So it starts with the ingredients then for you.
Usually.
So that's the inspiration. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, I've always been... Like, I hugely admire you for that skill, to just be able to see those unrelated 5 things in the fridge and be like, ah, I know just what to do. So, I mean, I'm so far from that. But, you know, I'm really happy that that's your strength, because it means I get really great food.
You're an appreciative audience.
Yeah. Yeah. But you mentioned sort of that internal dialogue. So, mm-hmm. So what is that? Like, I'm trying to pull that out of you a little bit more.
I taste things in my head.
Yeah, oh my gosh, okay. See, this is what I'm talking about. Okay. Okay.
I probably will never be able to remember anybody's name, and I couldn't necessarily tell you what I did last week, but I can tell you exactly how an avocado tastes and, you know, the texture and flavor in my mouth, and I can then put ingredients with it and figure out... you know, I'm thinking about making guacamole now. So, you know, I just have this ability to taste things and feel textures in my mind. And I don't know, that's just me. That's just how I work.
Yeah. Oh,
I'm tactile and kinesthetic, so you know, I have a very hands-on approach.
See, I didn't even know that, in terms of like seeing and tasting things in your mind. So then, do you think that's an innate skill, or do you think it's something that's learned?
I think it's I think it's something that's learned, but well, what is innate? I mean, I don't think you're born with something like that. I think you, it's like anything else. If golf was my passion, then I would probably live and breathe golf and be a good golfer, but it turns out I'm a horrible golfer. It's just, it's one of those things that you, you know, you love, and so you pay attention, and you, I find that you remember the things that you're really interested in. So you, you create this, this complex knowledge in your mind just from loving what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so then I'm trying to think back to some of the earlier things that you taught me. So what do you think are some of the... So you took this passion, and really your learning has been pretty organic this whole... throughout your cooking career.
Yeah, and I just know enough now to know that I know nothing. I mean, there's so much to know out there.
Well... I guess, but you know a lot compared to the average person, I think. And so what do you think are some essential cooking skills that, that the average person should know in order to try and get better at cooking?
How to pick good ingredients. I think mm-hmm. that is the absolute number one thing, mm-hmm. because good ingredients will do the work for you.
Okay. So what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean... you know, you've had an out of season apple, and what's it like? Describe it to me.
Right, flavorless, mushy.
Yeah, and then you know, describe to me a Honeycrisp apple in the middle of September.
Right, unbeatable.
Your mouth is starting to salivate already,
is.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. Of course. Yeah. Honeycrisp are my weak point.
Because you know how good it is when it's ripe and it's in season and it's that perfect level of readiness. And that speaks for itself. If you took those two things and made a pie, I guarantee you the pies would be vastly different.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the number one thing is to learn, you know, no matter where you are in the world, learn what is in season where you are and how to select a good quality ingredient and you know, and then how to store those ingredients so that you get the best out of them. And I think if you could learn one skill, that would be the number one.
Okay. So, yeah, and that's a, you know, it's a hard one with the way that the supermarkets are structured now and the way that the food miles that we log just in terms of, you know, eating stuff out of season. And you know, it turns out that, I don't know, like even some things that we eat, like, I was just looking at a cantaloupe the other day in the market, and it's summer, and it still comes from, I think it was Guatemala, and mm-hmm. I didn't buy it because of that, and it just didn't feel right about that, considering how much, you know, in-season fruit we have right now. But what would you, you know, in light of that, and in light of the temptation to buy, you know, the orange right that's in the market right now, even though that's not in season, mm-hmm. or that cantaloupe that came from halfway across the planet. So that temptation, we have access to that all year round. So mm-hmm. what would you advise in winter when those ingredients just aren't as readily available?
Choose something else.
Well, yeah, but...
I mean, it's... and just to be clear, I mean, the eco side of me says, hey, you shouldn't be supporting stuff that has been flown in here because, you know, there's this massive carbon footprint to get it. But the chef side of me says, hey, you know, that cantaloupe is maybe in perfect season right now in Guatemala or wherever you said it came from. And that ship or plane was coming here anyway. And guess what? This was harvested, you know, 3-4 days ago, and it's ripe and it's perfect. So it is in season, but you know, it's in season where it came from. It's not in season here. So that's a little bit more complex level to this, is knowing, you know, what's in season from where, because you may find that cantaloupe in season a different part of the year, but it has to come from a different place in the world too. So there is that element to it. But you know, the truth of the matter is, if you want wholesome food that is giving you the best healthful benefits, the best minerals, the best nutrition that you can get, it has to be ingredients that are ripe and ready.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, at Christmas, you might be eating pomegranates and oranges, and in the summer, maybe it's cantaloupes and raspberries. And don't eat cantaloupes and raspberries at Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're more rounded and more healthful, in my opinion, to be changing up your diet throughout the year. And, you know, there's lots of research on, you know, a winter diet versus a summer diet, or depending on what climate you live in, how that changes up, you know, different things in the spring, for example, to detoxify the body is, you know, well documented, or, you know, the root vegetable and higher protein, higher fat diets in the winter months. And there's a reason for that. Our bodies have evolved to eat seasonally.
Mm-hmm. And also cooked versus raw, like in cold versus warm months.
Yeah. And just the nice thing about the modern world is that seasonal diet has expanded because we can get stuff that's ripe from somewhere else. You know, mm-hmm. we're a long way from Florida, but we can get ripe oranges when the time is right.
Mm-hmm.
So I think just paying attention to that.
Mm-hmm. So all this talk then about food miles and local food obviously brings to mind, you know, what you think it means to eat sustainably in this day and age.
You know, I'm probably in a small school here. You know, there's people might raise their eyebrows at my answer to this, but I really believe that it's most important to support small craft makers and growers. And if that means getting, you know, getting really good quality cheese from a small farm in France that, you know, arrived yesterday on a plane, I think that's better than supporting the supermarket cheese that's pre-wrapped and who knows how much processing it's been through and how long it's been stored and mm-hmm. what preservatives are in it. And you know, those companies are mass producing, and when you weigh the cost, the environmental cost of that plane that's flying over here anyways,
mm-hmm.
Versus the mass production factories and farms that are doing this massive environmental degradation, I think we would find that supporting these small craft growers that are doing it in a sustainable and ethical way is by far the better thing for the environment, the better thing for our health, and the better thing for the economy.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with that too. So, you know, the combination of small batch producers and then eating in season, I mean, that takes you pretty far already.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a lot more to it. It's sort of a big question and a long conversation, but I think those are two really good points to take into account, is to try. Now, I mean, I guess that does mean doing a bit of research, though, because I think as a culture, we've gotten so used to just being able to walk into the supermarket, and that's where food comes from.
Mm-hmm.
It's born of convenience and just conditioning,
mm-hmm.
too. So there's something to be said. You have to get out into your community and get to know who's out there producing, because sometimes it's really surprising.
What I feel has happened in our society is that we have lost touch with food.
Mm-hmm.
It's a battery that we put in when we need it,
mm-hmm.
but we have no idea how it got there. And, you know, go visit a farm or have a little garden and just grow some tomatoes. Anything like that gets you back to really understanding the relationship of food and where it comes from and how it's produced, and it makes you appreciate it more. And I think that walking into the supermarket all of a sudden you start to cast your vote by your purchases.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at it and say, well, geez, I know that this tomato is like not in season at all, and it's flown a million miles to get here, and you know it's not ripe and it's not good quality, and don't buy it. You know, and I think the more that you recognize this, and the more that you start to live by it, the more you won't even crave those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and plus it's really fun to discover those stories.
It is.
I find, anyway. I mean, that's the magazine really revolves around that a lot of the time. And, you know, the family history or the process that actually goes into doing something, mm-hmm. it just increases your appreciation tenfold.
Mm-hmm.
It's really nice. So, you know, the other thing, too, I guess that we could say, just on the subject of sustainability, is organic.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on that?
I think that if at all possible, organic is the way to eat. I really truly don't know if all organic certification can be trusted. I really don't know that. Mm-hmm. But what I do know is that if we're casting our vote that way, that scrutiny will grow, and that there will be more available, and it certainly is going to be better than non-organic. I think that, you know, some cases organic is a lot more expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So if budget is a bit of a struggle, buy the things that you can afford organic, and the things that you can't, then you don't, but maybe eat less of them.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, buy them. That's the other thing. When they're in season, the cost is going to be comparable. But when they're out of season, the cost is going to be astronomical.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So, because organic farmers can only,
mm-hmm.
they can only grow when it's in season properly. They can't produce it with, you know, GMO and all this other, you know, nasty stuff that we do to our food. To me, organic, or even if it's not certified organic, you know, finding where the food comes from and understanding their process and their philosophy on food is important.
Mm-hmm.
And if they aren't certified organic because it's expensive to do or whatever their reasoning is, if they are growing it in the proper way you know, being mindful of the way that they're doing it,
mm-hmm.
then that's something you should support.
Mm-hmm. Well, typically what I've noticed is that if there's real pride in the product,
yes,
which most farmers truly have, then there's also an investment in the quality, and they want it. They truly want it. They invest their life in mm-hmm. producing something that is the best it can be. And so, you know, that takes it so far. It really does.
And we know farmers that have massive farms, and they're growing these heavily chemically treated and GMO cash crops because that's what they can survive on.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they're able to sell. But the more that we cast our vote towards something different, the more that those people will be able to make a livelihood growing that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I'm already seeing all kinds of micro farms growing up,
mm-hmm.
popping up. And those are the ones that I really like to support, because they're doing it in the right way.
Right.
And it's not monoculture, and it's not, you know, mm-hmm. so on and so forth.
Yeah, no, exactly. Me too. So what advice then would you give someone? Because I know that, I'm jumping around a little, but I know that one of the things that comes up so much is that people just don't know how to start. They don't know how to break their old habits, or they just don't know where to start looking, and so they just don't do anything because they just feel paralyzed by choice or by the amount of knowledge that's out there, the sheer scope of it. So someone who wants to start cooking and eating more healthfully and sustainably, what would you say to them?
Baby steps.
Mm-hmm.
Go online, take a look at the Dirty Dozen list, buy those organic.
Yeah.
There's your first step to more healthful eating.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then just take it one step at a time. It doesn't have to be an overnight thing, but it's something that's so life-altering, it seems, in the beginning, that it seems just impossible to do. But if you take on little bits at a time, you'll actually find that not only is it easy to do, but you want to do it, and then the stuff that you used to eat and like, you won't even like it anymore.
Yeah, it's an interesting
thing. That's the funny thing.
Yeah.
I mean, basically, the only thing that has survived for me is the odd potato chip. But other than that, and I can't even eat crappy potato chips, I have to buy the expensive ones.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you'll find that your body just starts to naturally reject the processed food and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is an interesting, you're right. I mean, you hear people say about giving up sugar, and then things just taste like syrup to them. Like, they can't go back to it.
I can't eat candy anymore. It just tastes terrible to
me.
It tastes like chemicals. Yeah.
Which it is.
Yeah.
So that's an important point, then, is baby steps. And I find that that's something that Pure Green talks about a lot, because it really is the truth.
Don't bite off more than you can chew.
Yeah. You know, it really is about choosing one thing and getting the hang of that until it feels easy, and then moving on to the next thing. Because otherwise it does feel overwhelming, unless you're me. And then that's just the way it goes.
just get a you, and then your life will be turned upside down.
Yeah. Yeah, but, you know, with everyone's schedules the way they are, and busyness and stress, then one small thing at a time is the way to go.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, what is your favorite thing to cook, or your favorite meal right now?
I think my favorite thing has always been, and probably always will be, spaghetti sauce.
Yeah, me too.
It's simple, but it's so satisfying, and I love making spaghetti sauce from scratch.
And your recipe for that is also in Volume 7, along with the macaroni and cheese. That's a good one to pick up, clearly. So, what do you want to experiment with more?
I would like to play a little bit more with gluten-free, dairy-free options. You know, we eat pretty well, but we do eat dairy and wheat still in our family, and it's something that I would like to reduce, not necessarily get rid of, because I do like that, and you know, if you're eating good quality stuff, I really don't think it's a problem, unless it's it is a problem for your body. But I'd like to I'd like to try getting into some more recipes that don't involve that. So that's something I think I'd like to play with a little more. Also, I'm attracted right now to Middle Eastern food, so I'm wanting to learn a little bit more about that.
That's something I didn't know, which excites me, because I like Middle Eastern food.
Mm-hmm.
So why specifically gluten and dairy?
I think they're the two biggest offenders for health, but I think they're the ones that we tend to overdo.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
And it's easy to overdo dairy, because you have yogurt in the morning, or you have milk on your cereal, and then you have milk in your coffee, and then you have, butter on your toast, and you have, you have whipped cream on your, I want strawberry shortcake right now. where was I? You have cheese on your sandwich, and it's so easy to eat a ton of dairy in a day, and not even realize you've done it, because it's little bits at a time.
Yeah.
And it's the same with bread, or wheat. You have your cereal or your toast, and then you have a sandwich, and then you have pasta, and then a cookie after dinner or something, and all of a sudden you've just eaten this massive amount of gluten through a day. And I believe that to be healthful, you have to be moderate. And I think that those are the two things that we overeat.
I mean, again, definitely, I agree. And we buy organic milk. That's one thing, I guess. Researching what are some of the things that are problematic in terms of either the industry or in terms of, with milk, especially butter, there's toxins stored in the fat.
Yes.
And so, figuring out those types of things, and so consequently we eat organic dairy if we can, but organic cheese is crazy expensive. So, I definitely agree. Those are two things that I'd love to cut down on as well.
And I think you can partially do that by you know, yes, organic, and, you know, for example, your butter, you can make ghee and get rid of the milk solids.
Mm-hmm.
You can, there's lots of substitutes as well. So, you know, there are really good nut butters for your toast, or
mm-hmm.
Coconut butter, or other alternatives, really good creamy honey, or things like that. And, you know, the same with your wheats. You can eat more ancient grains. You can eat things that are much lower in gluten to reduce that intake. And then, you know, start figuring out different ways. I'm a sandwich guy. I always have been. I love my sandwiches for lunch.
Mm-hmm.
I can eat a sandwich for every meal, really. But, you know, for me, that's how do I get rid of my bread? And so, you know, coming up with new ways or new patterns for your lunch, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So just, you know, working that in, even, you know, 1 or 2 days a week, just eliminating it until you get used to it, and then it becomes easy.
Mm-hmm. And that's something I love about us too, is that we are constantly evolving and always learning.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's important too. I think when, you know, going back to that earlier discussion about food in the modern family, we tend to have our favorites, and, you know, Tuesday is spaghetti night, and, you know, it just kind of, it's easy to get stuck. And so learning and breaking out of your comfort zone on a regular basis keeps those creative juices flowing.
Yep. But it's good to have the odd backup that you can just, like, you know, when we're talking about being so busy and stuff like that, that you don't have to think, you can just make your spaghetti sauce.
Yeah, well.
So it's good to have that too.
Of course, I agree wholeheartedly, because those end up being your favorites too.
Absolutely.
So just before we go, is there anything else that you'd like to add?
Don't be afraid of it, but more importantly, don't beat yourself up over it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you have to get a store-bought dinner or something like that, or, you know, if you go over to a friend's house and they're serving something that you, you know, that you've tried to eliminate from your diet and stuff like that, don't worry about it. Just eat it. I mean, it's more important to feel good about what you're doing, but, you know, you can make a massive amount of change to what you're doing with some very, very small steps. So it's not as daunting as it appears. And if you don't know where to start and you don't know, you know, what to do, then find somebody who does and get a little mentorship, or send us an email if you have some questions, and, you know, we'd be happy to answer it.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, feel good about what you're doing first and foremost. Don't beat yourself up over it, and, you know, just take baby steps, and you can really, you'll find that you'll wonder how you ever did it the other way.
That's true.
You know, you just can't go back after that.
Yeah, no, it's very true. Well, thank you very, very much. I really appreciate you coming on and sharing what you know with our listeners, and I'm sure it won't be the last time.
Well, thanks for having me. Aren't you happy I didn't say anything too bad? I had you worried.
Maybe a
little. My filter wouldn't be on. That was fun. I'd love to do this again.
Well, thank you.
So that concludes my talk with Jonathan. I hope you're feeling inspired to get in the kitchen and create. As always, we've prepared show notes for you over at puregreenmag.com/podcast/Jonathan, where, as promised, you can find the recipe for his mac and cheese. Jonathan has created over 50 recipes for the magazine so far, and many readers have written in to share their love for his creations. If you haven't yet tried his butternut squash, coconut milk, lime, and honey soup from Volume 9, you are missing out. The recipe is available to our digital subscribers, and if you subscribe as a result of listening to this show, I'll grant you a free month's pass. Just send us an email at subscribe@puregreenmag.com with episode 30 in the subject line, and I'll extend your subscription on us. Thank you so very much for listening. I'm Celine McKay, and this is the Pure Green Podcast.